Today is day 488, which are 69 weeks and 5 days of the captivity of now 79 hostages, living and dead, in Gaza.
This is TLV1.
This episode may contain explicit language.
The Promise Podcast, brought to you on TLV1, the voice of the city that this week started illuminating with bright floodlights of various and changing colors the three big industrial oil tanks on the east bank of the Yarkon River estuary, where the river meets the sea, not to get all political about it. Which three big industrial oil tanks, covering 20,000 square meters of some of the most lovely and expensive real estate in the city, the country, and indeed the world, the three big industrial oil tanks were constructed in 1938, 1939, and 1945, respectively, to hold the fuel oil used by the nearby Reading Power Plant, which, when it came online in September 1938, produced 24 megawatts of electricity. During World War II, fighter pilots from the Royal Italian Air Force tried unsuccessfully to bomb the power station and the oil tanks. And during the War of Independence, fighter pilots from the Royal Egyptian Air Force tried to do the same. But all these efforts to break the city's access to electricity failed. For years thereafter, the Reading Power Station continued to make power for the city just a few hundred meters from our home on the north end of the Tel Aviv port, which some epidemiologists believe accounts for the elevated rates of cancer in the 5-city block radius just around our house, though other epidemiologists say that this apparent bubble is consistent with the random variations endemic in medical statistics, to which the first epidemiologists say, yeah, well, I've forgotten more about medical statistics than you will ever know, to which the other epidemiologists say, what Eastern European medical school did you graduate from anyway? The University of Serbo-Croatia, to which the first epidemiologists say, hey, USC is a great school, but I digress. In any case, ever since the fuel source used at the Reading Power Station was switched in 2006 from oil to natural gas, the three big industrial oil tanks on the east bank of the Yarkon River estuary have been empty and unused. And in 2022, the entire Reading Power Station was retired on the thought that maybe there are better ways to make energy these days and better places than on the beautiful shores of a city whose real estate is, as I said, among the most valuable real estate of any city in the world. Originally, the power station and the oil tanks were going to be taken down, but then the planners of the city had a change of heart, deciding instead to preserve the shells of the old structures, repurposing them rather than wrecking them. There are some practical reasons why taking a ball to the 87-year-old, now defunct structures is a complicated affair. The original construction involved asbestos and other potentially dangerous things, making it hard and expensive to take the old buildings and storage tanks down. Plus, laws and regulations have changed over the years, and you're no longer allowed to build anything so close to the shore. So development on the spot into anything other than open beach and park is practically impossible. However, buildings that are already standing, well, they are grandfathered in, and they can be renovated and changed in all sorts of ways, even though they are close to the seashore and the riverbank, a sort of loophole that creates possibilities for the planners. In the event, the city recently announced that it will soon announce, and I have now announced that the city announced that it's gonna announce, so you should tell your friends in a particularly declaratory way that I announced what the city announced about announcing an architectural competition to make something fabulous out of the old oil tanks. And already, even before the competition has been officially announced, the A. Lehrman Architects and Town Planners firm over on Hasharon Street have put together some early sketches and mock-ups of their ideas for the oil tanks, one which turns a tank into a huge performance space with a beautiful hardwood stage at one edge and ascending rows of seats contoured to match the curve of the tank walls facing the stage. It is beautiful. and for another tank, the static top of which has been replaced with a huge, clear, retractable roof over a big exhibition space in the round, with the walls left the same rusty iron that they are now. And the third tank, it seems to be turned into a shallow pond or fountain. It is all very, very spectacular, and this is before the competition has even got underway. The lights that were first turned on this week, which will, we are told, be changed in a topical sort of way. On Tu Bishvat, they will be green. On May 1st, they will be red. During Pride Month, they will be red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet, and so on. The purpose of the colorful lights is to show all of us that something great is underway, that the old, antiquated, and obsolete husks of days gone by are sprucing up to be the fabulous new places they'll soon be in our lives and in our hearts. And arguably nothing captures the new wine into old vessels spirit of this city we love so well, Tel Aviv Yafo, better than 20,000 meters of rusting and decaying iron suddenly taking on new light and new life for us, showing us that what was old can be new again, what was bent can be made straight, and what was then can be deliriously now. Here with us in the beautiful Serenity Studio on tree-lined and pastoral Lesser Uri Street is a woman whose prose, like the old Reading Station and all that went with it, is full of power, utterly electric, its ample energy bringing light and warmth to our lives, and, like the new Reading Station and all that goes with it, is a repository of cultural and spiritual renewal. Obviously, that woman could only be Alison Kaplan Summer. Alison has written for Politico, The New Republic, Foreign Policy, The Jerusalem Post, The JTA, The Forward, and many other of your very best papers and magazines. She is a columnist with Haaretz. You have seen her on I-24 television and Al Jazeera TV, and you have heard her on NPR, PRI, and the BBC, and of course, the Haaretz podcast that she hosts. Alison holds a B'nai B'rith World Center Award for Journalism recognizing excellence in diaspora reportage, and a Simon Rockhour Award for excellence in covering Zionism, Aliyah, and Israel. Alison, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It was only a couple of years ago that I met somebody from the British city of Reading to understand that R-E-A-D-I-N-G is supposed to be pronounced Reading and not Reading, making me understand that I have been mispronouncing the name of that power plant for several decades.
And also presumably the railroad in Monopoly. Were you pronouncing it Reading all the time? Take a ride on the Reading?
Absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely.
My God. Yeah, that's just wrong.
A lifetime of mispronunciation.
Oh, my God. Wow. You should go straight to jail. That's my feeling about the matter.
And don't pass go.
And don't pass go. Now, my name is Noah Ephron. I don't mean to boast, but City Hall is a very long, thin building that sits on an east-west axis, and each floor has two long parallel hallways, one for the offices that face south and the other for the offices that face north. My office is on the west end of the north corridor, but sometimes when I get off the elevator at the bank of elevators near the middle of the building, instead of walking west on the north corridor to my room, I walk west on the south hallway to my room. The reason for this is that the men's room is at the southwest end of the building, and I usually wash my hands because my bike lock has oily schmutz on it. So I get out of the elevator, and instead of using the north hallway, which would make the most sense, I use the south hallway so that I pass the bathroom. Mind you, the two parallel hallways are only 5 meters apart. And I do this most every morning, and every day, at least one of the office managers or administrators who sit in the offices on the south-facing corridor, they see me walking by their office and they jump up from their desk and they race after me and they say, "Noah, Noah, Noah, your office is on the other side," meaning that even after 10 months of me being in the building every day, they are concerned that I am wandering the floor without a clue as to where my room is. And it happens every single day. And please, please believe me when I say I'm not bragging. I like to think that my parents raised me better than that. But somehow I put out a vibe that is, I don't know, some rarefied combination of hopelessness and cluelessness that make people just want to look after me. I think it's because they know that if they don't, I am just not very likely to make it through the day. And it is really not a boast when I say that while some people have to resort to such traits as charm or human warmth or likability or charisma to get by in the world, I found a way to turn incompetence and haplessness into a survival strategy. It may be that incompetence and haplessness are my superpowers. Today, we got two topics of profound importance. But first, we have this matter in memoriam. We buried last Thursday at 2 in the afternoon in Hayarkon Cemetery, Yisroel Rotnitsky. In attendance were Yisrael Rotnitsky's wife, Riva, his two daughters, Dorit and Rachel, and friends and colleagues and acolytes and admirers, mostly from among the Yiddishists of Tel Aviv and around the country, Yiddishism being a community and a calling that Yisrael Rotnitsky had in one way or another devoted most of his last 64 years to, since moving to Israel from Vilna in 1961. "I was a Yiddishist carrying out a war for the sake of Yiddish," Yisrael Rotnitsky once said in an interview, though that hardly captured who he was. Last June, Yisrael Rotnitsky turned 100. It was then that I learned about him for the first time. People wrote short appreciations, and there was an article in the Yiddish Vorwärts. And these appreciations led me to other short appreciations from a few years ago after, in 2021, the Israel National Institute for Yiddish Culture gave Yisrael Rotnitsky a Lifetime Achievement Award. And these short appreciations led me to a two-hour interview that Yisrael Rotnitsky did 10 years ago for the Yiddish Book Center in Amherst. And I listened to it, though it is in Yiddish and I have no Yiddish, and your years of grad school German will only take you so far. But still, listening to the words, even understanding just a few of them, you can feel the force of the man, the life of him. And all week I've had the interview on while I did other things. It's on my phone and I've been listening while I run in the morning or ride my bike here and there. I listened to it pedaling my way to the studio this morning. The basic facts of Yisrael Rotnitsky are astonishing. His is one of those stories. He was born in a small village about 100 kilometers from Vilna called Haidutz Shitstok in Yiddish. Today it is mostly called Adutishkis in Latvian. There were maybe 800 Jews there when Yisrael Rotnitsky grew up, out of a population of maybe 2,000. And they all of them lived, as Yisrael Rotnitsky once wrote, quote, "on five streets and three alleyways. Among the Jews, there were two schools, one Yiddish and one Hebrew, and they did not get on well. In the town, there were two synagogues, one Hasidic and one Mitnaged. There was an orchestra of wind instruments, a firefighting crew, and branches of the Hashomer Hatzair Socialist Youth Movement and of the Bund, both of which were centered in Vilna. Among the wind instruments, there were two cornets and two French horns, a tenor bassoon, a baritone saxophone, a bass tuba, and a drum with two brass cymbals," end quote. Yisrael Rotnitsky learned first in a cheder, but when he was old enough, he went to the Real Gymnasium for Mathematics and History in Vilna that had been founded in 1918, the first Yiddish high school in Vilna, by Tzaisho, the central Yiddish school organization, with money coming mostly from the left Poalei Tzion, Workers of Zion political party, and from the Bund. At the Real Gymnasium, one learned the great books, with special emphasis on Mendele Moicher Sforim, Shalom Aleichem, and Yud Lamed Peretz, and one learned from the new Program von Geschichte Limit, the new history curriculum, where the history of the Jews and the history of everyone else were never disentwined, and one learned from the Program von Naturlimud, the science and natural history curriculum, and one learned Hebrew and one learned mathematics. And there at the school, life was everything altogether. These basic facts of Yisrael Rotnitsky I know mostly from one of the many books he wrote and edited, this one called If the World War Had Started One Day Later. And it is really two books bound between the same covers. The first 160 pages on bleached, bright white paper in Hebrew, and the last 212 pages on yellow to sepia paper in Yiddish. After I learned that Yisrael Rotnitsky had died, I looked in the catalogs and bibliography.